This is Icon Art Radio with myself, Bill Teeple, and Alan Cobb and Donna Colby. Tell us about your experience in New York. Was it New York?
Yes, I went to visit my mom in New Jersey a week or so ago, and she lives a nice, easy 45-minute train ride from New York City, and my brother and I went in one day, and one of the things we went in to do was to eat at a certain restaurant that he, because he's a chef now, and he had heard of this wonderful, famous chef. So we spent 2 hours eating a magnificent lunch. But then after lunch, we wandered around the village, and he took me to a store that he had heard about. And it was one of the most unique, fascinating stores that I had ever seen, and I had known nothing about this product. It was a store specializing in cameras called Diana F. cameras, and on they also had Holga and a few other similar kind of cameras that are very, very simple cameras that have been made since the 1950s or 60s or sometime back then, and basically have not changed since. They're still the same simple, boxy format, little plastic cameras, medium format, the 120 film format cameras, and they even have the little thing sticking up, like a reflector thing that you put the flash bulbs in, and they have, over the year, they've kept making these cameras over the years, only changing the color. I think the first ones were gray with like turquoise on the sides, and now they have pink ones and lime green ones and things like that. But apparently, there's this huge, trendy fascination now with these cameras among the young art students in New York. And this store, which was a fairly good-sized store, the walls were completely papered with photographs taken from these cameras, and they were arranged on the wall in a marvelous way, you know, with certain colors grouped together and all of that, and some repetition of images. They're focal, you know, you can't change the f-stops or anything, you know, they're just like the old snapshot cameras, and so you have a little bit of fuzziness around the outer edges of the picture, and they're just these little small pictures, and the colors are a little funny, you know, like the early color photography. But there was something very appealing about these images, and the way they're being used today is different. You know, what they're photographing, what they're choosing to photograph is different from the snapshots that we would have taken when we were kids if we'd had these cameras. So anyway, I was very intrigued because my brother went in. He was interested in getting one of these cameras for himself. And so he was asking specific questions to the proprietor, who obviously was really into them. And the proprietor he just totally lit up. And he was completely filled with passion over his topic that he knew so much about and was very dedicated to. He took us all around and showed us how they're now upgrading little attachments for this camera, so you can use 35mm film, and so you can make multiple images. They had, some of them were actually pinhole cameras, you know, that had like four holes instead of one, or eight holes or something, so you could do all kinds of tricky little things, but still have that low-tech look to your photographs. So anyway, I thought this was a good launching pad for us to discuss today. You know, it brings up a lot of things to that we could jump into, what makes something trendy and what makes retro technology interesting and that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's interesting. I have an attachment for my state-of-the-art Nikon D300 digital single lens reflex called a Lens Baby. And it's this weird contraption that goes on like a lens and contains a little funky little lens about a half an inch in diameter, 3/4 inch, which is nothing like, you know, the big hulking serious multi-$100 lenses that you normally put on a camera like that. And then it has three strange little threaded things sticking out so that you can completely misalign the lens. It's mounted on a section of corrugated plastic tubing. So you can grab the front of the lens while you're holding the camera and squish it. and you can focus it that way. And you can focus it and sort of tilt it off axis so that things that are near you are out of, you know, things on one side of the picture are in focus and on the other side of the picture are out of focus. And it's used for various kinds of special effects, but one popular use of it is for photographing things that are not miniature in a way that makes them look like they are miniature. Because it turns out we're so used to seeing photographs of things that are taken with close-up lenses as having a very shallow depth of field. So like a photograph of the town square, the center of the square would be in focus and the far side and the near side would be out of focus if it was a model of the town square that was only a couple of feet wide. So if you take a real photograph of the square and render the distant part out of focus and only a little band of focus in the middle, when you look at that photograph, it suddenly you see the people as being little toy people, and the cars look like toy cars, and the whole thing it takes on this sort of magical miniature quality. And that's sort of, I guess that's just an example of how, you know, using cameras in a different way from the norm, you know, which of course is to get an accurate reproduction of something that you see. But there are ways of abusing a camera creatively that are, you know, they're very interesting.
Well, and that may be why these old retro cameras are interesting to these art students, because photography has gone, you know, to this, like, super clear, you know, images that are very realistic and everything, and now they want to do something different. Let's go back to the distortions of the past.
Well, very recently, Polaroid announced that they were ceasing production of their instant film. Mm-hmm. And the outcry that went up to, you know, for somehow please continue making the film didn't come from people with their SX-70s taking snapshots of birthday parties. They came from the artists. Uh-huh. All over the planet, people, these artists are saying, wait a minute, you mean I can't take any more of those weird little square pictures that you can't make enlargements of and that, you know, you can paint on and mm-hmm. all
this
stuff.
This is an example because this is a trend in art. Polaroid transfers and Polaroid photography. There's actually coffee table books about Polaroid art.
Yeah.
And that's a good one because it's retro. It has a retro look. Mm-hmm. What is the feelings that we get off of this retro stuff that makes us feel we didn't get those feelings off of it when it was a fad? We often thought, oh, cool, new thing. But then you go back and you're picking up on it in a retro way. There's feelings you get off of it. There's lots of there's this memory stuff that we were talking about last week.
Yeah.
And your whole life at that moment flashes back on you.
Right.
A better picture of what those times were. Like good times are always, the old days are always good times and we don't remember the bad. And
right. I think there's even some brain chemistry thing that happens where there's like something called the nostalgia hormone.
Yeah, it's nostalgia that we're talking about.
Yeah, that you always feel good, you know, even if you're remembering something that wasn't pleasant back in your youth, you have the nostalgia hormone kicking in and modifying it somehow so that, I mean, not like super painful things, but things that just... you know, like if I remember certain foods that I couldn't stand eating when I was a kid, they were like my least favorite foods. But if they come up in conversation, there's some fondness I have in the memory of that food that I couldn't stand.
it's poignancy, I think. It's that sort of mixture of positive and negative that makes it intriguing to us. Also, I think the ultimate, I mean, the word that comes to my mind is evocative. Mm-hmm. It's the nostalgic stuff or the retro stuff evokes a time period.
Right.
So again, that time period is just filled with associations and issues and relevancies
and
connections.
I hated the 50s. by 1960, in the early 60s, or the early 60s, but I was trying to get as far away from that stuff as I possibly could.
Me too.
But now I'll go back and something that is exactly the flavor of 1960 or the flavor of 58 or something, mm-hmm. I'll enjoy in that nostalgic retro way.
See, I loved the 50s. I was a total little 50s girl, you know. I loved all of the things about the 50s, the little tea sets and playing house and the little, you know.
The kidney-shaped coffee tables.
Just, I liked the aesthetics. I liked everything about the 50s.
God.
The music, you know. I mean, of course, I was a little girl.
Well, yeah.
And
but when
so
you
I
were
was,
18 and you're...
Well, when I was 18, looking, it was already the 60s.
I know. So. And then when you look back on the 50s, did you look back on it fondly?
Oh, yeah. I've always looked back on the 50s fondly.
Wow. I was trying to escape.
I was, too. I was appalled by the 50s, even when I was 8 years old.
Well, I was appalled by the rules and, you know, certain rules and regulations of the 50s. But that, to me, seemed almost more a factor of just my parents and childhood than it did of what I liked about the 50s. I think what I liked about the 50s was just... It had all these surprising things, you know, like pink bicycles
avocado
plastic.
Kitchen appliances.
It's like, you know, I did go through a phase after I got older where I was like anti-plastic and all that and wanted everything natural. But when all those plastic things first came out in the 50s, they were Bakelite, you know, I guess Bakelite came out in the 30s, but there was a different quality of plastic things in the 50s than let's say plastic things made in the 80s, which didn't have any appeal.
Of course, there may be someone who looks back on their childhood in the 80s.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, Adrienne, my daughter, you know, she is fond of the 80s. You know, that was her childhood and memories. Wasn't it?
I remember we had fiberglass curtains in our living room. They were made of fiberglass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they made your fingers feel scratchy. And it
was, and they were all, and they, pretty soon the plastic would start to discolor on those things. They'd have I don't know about yours, but sometimes those things usually look a little
bit. And formica. I mean, when formica kitchen tables came out, you know, with those patterns on the top and all that, I thought that was the coolest thing. Like formica topped tables with chrome legs was just,
oh, God,
you know.
I hated them. Well, the first time I saw them.
At the time,
but I love formica itself. It's made, there's nothing could be more appropriate than to have a kitchen table or a kitchen counter made out of a substance that's produced by mixing urea and formaldehyde.
I didn't think about that.
I didn't know about that.
To me, it was modern. I remember thinking there were the old-fashioned houses, and there were the modern houses.
Yeah.
And the modern
houses. Love the perfection of a formica surface. I mean, if you need a smooth, flat, durable surface, formica is fabulous. It's really strong. It's incredibly durable. It resists burning, and I mean, people can put cigarettes down on it, and it won't melt it. Surface and everything, and it's flat. And
I think possibly one reason I liked the 50s was because my parents loved the 50s. Mm. They were both, had been really poor in the 30s and all through the 40s, even when I was born. The first, you know, several years of my life was, they were poor, and they had like old furniture that had been their parents, or, you know, they were just like used things. And so when they finally got money to buy new things for themselves, they wanted really modern items, and they were the 50, you know, these items of the 50s, a lot of which were made out of these artificial materials, and they were ecstatic over these things. You know, they just loved them, and probably there was some contagious feeling that I had from them, too, because it made them so happy to have these formica tables and the...
Don't get me wrong. I like formica. I mean, we had a wooden kitchen
I
table.
I think you're a formica hater.
No. We had a wooden kitchen table, and I personally put a formica top on it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I glued the formica down and, you know, trimmed the edge when I was, you know, 12. Mm. And it's...
One of your best friends...
It's because the table, the wooden table, had been painted a million times. It was a really old wooden table. Yeah. You know, it would have been nice to refinish it, except it was just a utility table. And, you know, going from generations of lead-based paint, which, you know, gets gummy after a while when it's many, many layers and it's got oil and food and stuff in it. And it's dented and, you know, the edges of it are kind of almost a wrinkle under your finger if you grab it too hard. And it had just gotten awful. And going from that to this perfect, absolute, flat, impermeable surface, and, you know, that was pretty cool.
I remember...
But the aluminum trim around it that filled up with furch and looked like aluminum trim, that I never could...
It filled up with what?
Furch. You know, where the aluminum trim is crimped over the top of the formica.
You can't clean
there's
in there.
There's an edge of gross, stinky,
food-like items.
Well, I just never heard the word furch. Is that just the gunk that gets stuck under there?
it's interesting. Now that this is kind of coming back for me, in the 50s itself, when I was a kid, I didn't really make that many judgments about, you know, I didn't have that strong of an opinion about, you know, my aesthetic opinions. I remember it was more this like, is it old or is it modern? And all this stuff was modern.
Right.
And I think I was like...
The word modern was modern.
Right, it's not now. That's retro now, to use the term. It wasn't until the late, when I was more able to have judgments and opinions about things from the other side of things, later 60s, that I, you know, was reacting very against the 50s. But in the middle of it, there was this strong thing between modernism, the modern, what is modern, and what was old-fashioned.
Yeah.
And my parents were definitely, like your parents, like, had bought into the modern as this is the way. But I remember, I was pretty much on the modern side too. I remember there was this sort of like, we're all going to a space age reality, you know, everything was going to get really slick.
We're all going to wear silver coats.
And that was one of the reasons why where it was like the modern smooth, everything like perfect, met the reality of entropy in the meeting of the as far as they could get with making this work was the little silver edge to the formica table. When what I wanted I really actually desired, and we're getting into some of Bill's psychology, a perfect slab of plastic.
Absolutely.
And then molded perfectly into the leg so there was no under...
You've got
no,
it.
No, like...
Corium.
So what I didn't like at all, and this is really going deep with me, because I had this real dislike of it as a kid, was the facade.
Right.
And all the older buildings had a facade, and then there's an old building behind it, and there was a facade.
Right.
And I also didn't like cars, because cars had this... shell and then all this stuff underneath that if you actually looked underneath you could see all the stuff.
That's right.
And I really wanted to see was a perfectly molded car.
Yes.
That
you didn't like the cars of the 50s?
I didn't like the process. See, we're getting at something. I have to lay on the couch and talk about how I feel about it. That I had a serious problem as a kid that this ideal in my head of the beautiful car that just rolled.
Yeah.
It didn't have any mechanisms inside. It was just like a mythic car rolling made out of perfect modern stuff, which would have been...
Machined out of a solid billet of
perfect
material.
When it was really just this machine, and then they would put a little coating around it that made it like look...
It's not even a complete shell. It's just the top and sides.
I don't know. I mean, we're actually bringing something up here. That was a serious problem for me. And it was not something that was ever resolved. It was that I accepted. I came to accept. Yeah. So then I would make decisions about cars based on how I had accepted them to be.
Yeah. Well, I felt the same way about that's what I didn't like about the sort of classic, expandable aluminum legged kitchen table thing. I remember as far back as the late 50s, just hating those things, because if you felt under, they had these funny, sculpted sides, but if you felt underneath, it just wrapped around, and then it was just sharp metal, and it was dirty and gross under there, and it wasn't. it claimed to be some sort of elemental, perfected, material, and it really wasn't. And it had rivets, and it had seams. And seams were very, very upsetting to me.
They
the thing
were
that was supposed
to
be perfect shouldn't have to have seams. It's okay for clothing to have seams, but like wallpaper, you shouldn't be able to see the seams. And in fact, wallpaper is another of the things that was really big in the 40s and 50s, yeah. And was going out into the 60s. And my mother had gotten into doing wallpaper to make our house look new again, sort of. And I just couldn't stand the idea of a picture that upon examination was really only about 18 inches square, and then it repeated. And it repeated all over the place, and it was offset a little bit from one strip to the next, so it wasn't too obvious. But as a kid, I'd lie there in bed sick, home from school for the day because I had a cold or something, and I'd be staring at the wallpaper, and I'd think, this is awful. It's like a nightmare. It just goes over and over and over, and there's nothing original in it. And I was looking for content, and it was like this stuff that had some sort of pretense that wasn't fulfilled. It didn't have the content that the pretense, claimed. And so I found it annoying, and I liked it, in the 60s when we started getting into making things out of wood again.
And painting the walls white or gray.
One of the things I liked about this sort of back to...
Yeah.
The older days of doing things is that the wood was solid. Yeah. It wasn't a facade. It wasn't like a smooth modern facade.
And if you look closely at the grain, it's got grain within the grain. And if you get a magnifying glass and look at the grain, there's more interesting stuff going on. And if you could get a microscope and keep looking at it, and there's even more interesting stuff. Whereas with the fake stuff, it's just a picture of grain, and it repeats.
Now, just to be go to the other side of the flip to the other side of the coin, because I was fond of wallpaper, and my parents were totally into wallpaper. And I have this one extremely amusing snapshot from my childhood. I think this was a picture from the late 40s of a room where my dad had done the wallpapering. There was wallpaper on all of the walls and a different kind of wallpaper on the ceiling.
Whoa.
The one on the walls had these like great big sort of tropical leaves and flowers and things on it. And then the one on the ceiling was like kind of like a trellis with ivy on it. Mm-hmm. That was on the ceiling. And the carpet was sort of this like molded brocade kind of pattern that many of the carpets had back then. And the sofa.
It wasn't just linoleum with a picture of a carpet?
No, this was real carpeting.
Okay.
And then the sofa, my mother had made the slipcovers out of another patterned fabric. So the entire room was like this pattern, like it was, a birthday present
patterns,
or something
right.
like that. But it was such a trippy thing. And I remember being, with 4 or 5 years old living in that room and loving it.
Yeah,
because it was like being in a jungle or something
Well, it could be
slightly
done well.
Unusual room.
I mean, it could be done.
Were all
well.
Of your rooms in your house that unusual?
Well, pretty
I'm pretty much categorize you as an unusual family.
Yeah, well, maybe we were. I thought it was pretty normal, I guess. But maybe I at that age, 4 or 5, you don't go to very many other people's houses. And I do remember the bathroom floor had this like linoleum with little speckles on all over it that were multicolored.
That was pretty normal.
And they were, I'm sure you guys had this experience too, there were faces and creatures in
Absolutely.
It. You'd sit there and look at those patterns in the linoleum, and there were incredible pictures in there.
Yeah, we had really good sort of swirly marble-like linoleum in our house in upstate New York.
And look at now.
I can still remember some of the pictures that I saw in that linoleum.
You go to the Green Building Supply Company and you find linoleum made out of, you know, contemporary green materials that look like the old speckled linoleum that we had back in the 40s
well,
and 50s.
There were good wallpapers. I mean, it wasn't all dreck. It's just that there was so much fake stuff. It was like people were easily fooled in the 50s,
well,
and they got a little more experienced in
the 60s. Fake was cool back then.
Well, I'm not sure. I think fake was new, and
it was a trend.
But the people selling the stuff learned how to make quick and dirty, cheap fake. And it wasn't, you know. I mean, we have fake wood paneling that's, you know, a masterpiece of faux painting that really is quite astonishing and has almost the richness of real wood. And then you have the stuff that's, you know, that's just rolled out of a machine and isn't particularly imaginative and isn't very well done. And I just think that people got into more and more just buying the latest fake stuff until we were inundated with... Remember, the 50s were also characterized by this sort of new explosion of materialism and keeping up with the Joneses and competing on possessions and having the biggest fin on your car and that kind of stuff. And by the end of the 50s, the cars were encrusted with gigantic bulbous chrome, you know, globules and huge fins and rocket taillights and stuff. And people, you know, even the relatively average consumers, you know, finally just couldn't take any more of it.
And then we replaced them in the 60s in our anti-materialist phase with Volkswagen buses that we encrusted
painted
with peace symbols and tie-dyed fabric and all kinds of bumper stickers and everything.
Well, it wasn't the encrustation that was bad. It was the uniformity of it, I think, that people didn't like.
Well, it just got way beyond form and function, too, on a more artistic level. It got way into... But the thing is, I think at that point, I felt that there was some... out of balance in terms of form and function. And they seemed kind of like overdone. So it was comfortable. It was refreshing to go back to the other. But nowadays, I think people that thought they were stupid at the time sort of think they're beautiful because of the retro factor, the nostalgia factor.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.